This is Dave Crippen at the Henry Ford Museum. We have another one of our series of interviews with key industrial designers. Today we're speaking with Robert F. Bob Zokas, Z-O-K-A-S, who has been with Ford for almost, how many years, Bob?
29 years tomorrow.
29 years tomorrow on July 11th. And this is July 10th, 1984. You're going to let Bob tell his story in his own way, and we hope that that you will be candid and subjective, Mr. Zokas.
So you'd like to start way back, huh? How I get involved in this? And
right. I think it's helpful to have a discussion of your the influences on you in terms of.
Well, going way back, my mother always told me that ever since I could hold a pencil in my hand, I was drawing cars. So I grew up and I was always drawing cars. I'd draw the teacher's cars in the art class, and I just couldn't get cars out of my mind, loved cars. And but before, when the war broke out, World War II, I decided to go into mechanical engineering at Northeastern University of Boston. Because my father, he felt drawing cars, that was just what an artist did. And he didn't want to be an artist in a garret starving.
Were you from the Boston area?
I'm originally from Massachusetts, yeah. Okay. So he kind of talked me into, you know, engineering was a thing in those days, you have to be an engineer. So I followed that course for 3 months and decided I didn't like that at all. And then I joined the Navy, went in the Navy. While I was in the Navy, it just hit me that I just wanted to somehow design cars. And when I get out, I went to a school in Boston called the Vesper George School of Art. The school had an industrial design course, which I took. And I was in it a few months and decided I really didn't think this course was going to do me any good. So I switched over to advertising, which was the main function of the school. That was its main. And I graduated with honors, and I was in advertising for about 5 years, ended up at Photon, which was a company that was designing a new machine for setting type. And I was a type designer there for a year or two. And it just so happened this boss I had, he loved cars. Mm-hmm. Well, he loved Oldsmobiles. He had an Olds 88.
At Photon.
And the Olds 88, of course, at that time was the hottest car on the road. So he was always after me, well, draw me what you think the 1957 Oldsmobile will look like, or draw me this old, that old. And he kept inspiring me, and he finally got me to do something about it. He says, why don't you write to these automobile companies? And I said, well, I don't know where to write. In those days, I thought I had this idea that the designing was done by the advertising agencies. That's how far out I was. But anyway, one day I got one of the automotive magazines from California, and on the back page was a large photograph of Gene Bourdonnais, who at that time was the chief stylist of the Lincoln Mercury Studio. And that kind of triggered me, and I started to put a portfolio together, drawing cars. In the meantime, Motorama, which you remember General Motors had the Motorama series,
right,
going around the country, they were coming to Boston. And they advertised for clay modelers and designers. Well, at the time, my portfolio was out here at Ford. I had already heard from Chrysler. Chrysler thought I wanted to be an engineer. They sent me all kinds of papers to sign that I would waive any inventions to them. So that didn't work out, and I went for this interview, and all I had was a few slides of my work, and that really didn't go too well. They like to see original sketches and so on. So I got a letter from GM rejecting me. In the meantime, I got a letter from Ford, a telegram.
What year was this?
This was in 1955. Yeah. And pardon me, I didn't get a telegram. What I finally did was I decided to just take a week's vacation and drive to Detroit because I wasn't getting anywhere through the mails. So I came out here, and it was one hot July day, and my poor wife was dying in the car out in the parking lot. And I was all day in personnel and trying to sort out what I wanted to be, you know, where they wanted to put me. And I went over to Design Center here and had several interviews. And then Roy Brown, who at that time was heading up the Edsel studio, he hired me.
Uh-huh.
And I was just thrilled to think that I was going to get into this business. because I was really more than thrilled when they told me what salary I was going to be making. Compared to the Boston salaries, this was quite fantastic. So I left by myself, left the wife and kids home, and come out here by myself to Detroit and get a room at the YMCA down in Clark Park, which I sure wouldn't want to be down there now. And then started looking for a home for the family and finally got settled out here in August. So I started out in the Edsel studio, but not as a designer. They hired me as an illustrator. And at that time, what they used to do, the illustrators used to set up the shows for management. In other words, the designers designed, did their sketches, and then we made a nice display on large boards and set up the whole show for management. Fortunately, I had a good boss there, too. He knew I wanted to get into design. He says, Bob, whenever you have any free time, go ahead and draw cars all you want.
Who was that?
That was Bud Parks.
Bud Parks?
Mm-hmm.
Park or Parks?
Parks.
Parks.
So Bud Parks was real generous in that respect, and I picked up a lot of tricks from the studios, of course. And it was only 2 or 3 months, and they put me in the studio. And at that time, I worked for Ken Spencer, who was the exec of Advanced and Interiors. And we did all Advanced Edsels at that time. Jim Sipple, he kind of caught on to me. At that time, he was the exec of the production interiors and exteriors, and he needed somebody to do the lettering for the car, and he saw that I had that ability because I came from Photon, I had been a type designer, I had been in graphics. So nights on overtime, I did the designing of the lettering for the Edsel car.
That's your design?
Yeah, on the exterior.
That everyone saw in the front.
Right.
Yeah.
So then Jim wanted me so much, he said, how would you like to transfer into the department?
Jim
Sipple. Ken Spencer, and I thank him to this day, he says, Bob, I'm not going to hold you back. If you want to go ahead. But I'll tell you one thing. If you go, that's all you'll ever do the rest of your career is lettering. You'll be branded. So I took his advice, and I didn't go. And I was very thankful that I didn't. Later on, I worked on the 58, 59, 1960 Edsel instrument panel. I was in interiors, what they called hard trim at that time. They used to separate the soft trim and the hard trim. There was a department that did all the seats and door panels, and a department that did the panels. And from there, I went on to the
instrument panels.
Mm-hmm. Then, of course, as you know, the Edsel went away.
Incidentally, as an aside, we've interviewed Roy Brown, and he's very proud of the Edsel. He said, "I will never feel that it wasn't a good design."
Oh, I agree with him.
He said, yeah. "I think it was badly." Badly sold, badly promoted, and
yeah.
He said, "They almost put it on the shelf from the beginning."
Yeah.
But those of us who worked at the Edsel were always proud of our design.
That's right.
And I think that's largely true.
They worked very hard on that to get a very distinctive front end. We researched all the front ends of cars of that period and wanted to get something that was really unique, it would stand out from a distance. And I know when I first came into the studio, they had very nice, delicate chrome vertical bars for the grill.
Yes, you mentioned that.
And engineering, because of cooling, opened that grill up, and wasn't quite as attractive as what the original.
That may have taken some of the onus off the front end,
mm-hmm.
which, even though I liked the oval, apparently a lot of people didn't.
Yeah. And then Bill Schmidt, who had Lincoln Mercury Studio at the time, left and went to Packard. And come out with a Packard Predictor. I don't know if you remember that show car in 1956,
right.
And there was our Edsel front ends.
Right. In fact, I think Bunky Newson,
Little Pontiac,
came up with almost an identical design to Pontiac.
Exactly right. Yeah. Yeah.
So it still lives, as you well know, in car clubs. They're more popular than ever.
I know it, and getting more popular. Yeah. No, I was real pleased to be part of it. And, from there, then I went into interior studios and worked on the Comet. Instrument panel, the Mercury, 1960 Comet, 1961 Mercury.
I had a 63 Comet, and I liked it very much. It was a good instrument panel.
It was.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was in interiors for that period of time, and I think it was finally moved to exteriors. Let's see. Went in the Ford design office. That can't be right. No. Yeah, I was still working between 55 and 65. Around 63, I went into the exterior studio under Buzz Grissinger. He was the chief stylist. Mm-hmm.
Were you glad to get into exterior?
Oh, yes, I was. I enjoyed interiors, but I think I've always had a leaning towards the exterior of the car.
I've noticed that. There seems to be a sort of a sigh of relief when, although they enjoy working in interiors, it's nice to get out and work on the exterior of the car.
Well, interiors is extremely difficult. It's a very, very difficult project because you have to package the radio, the heater, all the controls, and it's not that easy, and especially you get into the seats and the door panels, and there's countless items that have to be looked into.
Tiny, minute things.
Yeah, even to a coat hook, which you might spend weeks on just a coat hook. So it's very involved, very complex, and I think that it doesn't give you the freedom that you have in the exterior of the car.
Yeah. The sense of really, flowing kind of situation.
And it's too bad they're kind of the unsung heroes because, you know, the person lives in the interior of his car more than he looks at the outside. But the outside is the emotional part of the whole business.
Yeah.
It's strange.
I guess it isn't until just recently that the people have begun to think about the ergonomics.
Yeah, getting into that quite heavily now. Ford is, and, well, everybody is.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Europeans have had that for quite some time. And it's about time we started to think about the customer's comfort and reach and vision zone. So gearing on, I get into Exterior Studios, and at that time we had what we called a Meteor. Remember the Meteor?
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, I worked on the 62, 63, and 64 Meteor, and also on the 64 and 65 Mercury.
The Meteor has become a cult automobile also. People are restoring those.
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
I haven't seen too many of those.
Yeah, they're beginning to pop up again. It's it fascinates them more, I think, than the Mercury because of the distinctive.
Well, there probably weren't that many produced.
That's
anyway.
True. Yeah,
and they didn't run too long. I think it was just 62 through 64.
At this point, in the mid to late 60s, what is the situation in the design center in terms of administration and the people you work for? What is there a is it a happy, productive atmosphere at this time?
Yes, at that time I do remember.
Things are going well.
Yeah. Yeah, and
Gene Bordenay
was vice president, and things seemed to be going quite well, and we're working a lot of overtime, working very hard, and in my recollection, I don't recall any problems at that time.
George Walker has left, and
much
of the internecine warfare has subsided.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah,
that was kind of a peaceful period, I'd say. So from there, I went into Ford Exteriors, and at that time I was promoted to manager, which I was quite thrilled about.
Mm-hmm.
And oddly enough, a side story on that Joe Orris was the chief stylist, and Joe, you could write a book about Joe. If I knew how to write a book, I would. Super guy, completely devoted to Ford Motor Company.
Tell us a bit about Joe.
Well, when I got this promotion, and I didn't know I was going to be promoted, we were all packed, ready to leave the house, and we're going on a 3-week trip to California on the train.
Your family?
The family. Mm-hmm. I figured the children had never been on a train before. This might be the last time. Mm-hmm. So we had planned this trip long before. Just ready to go out the door and lock it, and the phone rings. And it's Buzz Grissinger. And he says, Bob, he was my boss in Lincoln Mercury at the time. Bobby says, I'm calling because we're all sitting here, except the principal is not here, and that's you. You've been promoted to manager, and you're going to work for Joe Orris in Ford Exterior. Of course, my heart was just going.
Sure.
And I says, well, gee, Buzz, I'm ready to go out the door. You know, I'm going on vacation and so on. He says, well, Joe Orris does want to talk to you. I would call him if I were you. So I said, just a minute, Marilyn, my wife. Before I could call, the phone rang, and it was Joe. Well, Bob, I understand you're going to be working for me. That's fine. But I understand you're going on vacation. I says, yes, Joe. I'm ready to go out the door now. I have to catch a train. Well, can't you come in and talk to me? I have some things I want to go over or discuss with you. And I said, Joe, I can't. You know, you can imagine the bind I was in here. I'm just promoted. I'm going to work for this guy, and he wasn't making it any easier. Well, I don't understand it. 3 weeks, he says, you're going for 3 weeks, and I'm not going to have you for 3 weeks? We have a lot going on here in Ford Studio, and there's a lot of things I want to go over with you, and, that is indeed unfortunate. I want you to report to me first thing in the morning that you get back from your vacation. Okay, so I can imagine, for 3 weeks,
oh,
I had this on my mind.
Spoiled, yeah.
So I got back on that Monday, and I ran right to his office. He didn't remember. He says, what? I wanted to see you about what? Well, you just go down to the studio and get settled, and, you know, well, the whole thing was...
Marvelous.
Well, all for years after that, of course, I was never known as Bob. I was known as Paul to him. I was Paul.
Why was that?
Who knows? he never got anybody's name straight.
Was that one of his idiosyncrasies?
Yeah. Yeah, he had a party at his house one Sunday for all of us. And I can always remember watching him behind the screen door, and he had a card. Hello, Bob and Mary Ellen. He could never remember a name. If we were going to go over a moving of people or promoting of people, he had to have cards up on the wall with the photographs of each individual. Now, who's that? Oh, yes. All right. I know him.
I've seen him around.
Yeah. And it was funny. He used to come in this, well, after years later, he was in 40 Europe, and he'd come back on visits now and then. And he'd going down the hall, he'd say, hello, Paul. How are you? And one time he said to me, when he was on one of these trips back, Bob, how are you, Bob? See, I got it right.
So at least he understood his shortcoming.
But in the afternoon I saw him again, he's, hi, Paul. But that was the kind of guy he was, you know.
Well, tell us a bit about the regime at Ford Studio under Oroz. Everyone mentions him as a really key person in that period. Yeah.
He was, because he was a hard worker. He was so devoted to the company. He wouldn't even... I mean, if some crisis came up on a car, he was canceling a trip to Europe once, I remember, a vacation with his wife. And I remember Gene Bourdonnais saying, now look, Joe, you go. He didn't go. He canceled the whole trip. He would not leave that place. And we used to work 5 hours overtime a night, you know, for 4 nights a week. And we didn't work Friday nights. We worked 8 hours Saturday. And I, at that time, had Galaxy Studio. After I was in the pre-production area for a short time. And there I worked on the 66 Thunderbird roof, and then some advanced Thunderbirds and Fords. Then he transferred me to Galaxy Studio, which at that time was quite an honor to have. You know, Galaxy was the
top
car, that was top of the line. And I remember on Fridays, I'd be there trying to write notes on what occurred. We had shows on Fridays.
Every Friday was
every Friday.
Day, yeah.
Yeah. And I'd be the only one left in the studio. Everybody else had gone home because there was no overtime on Friday. And Joe would come in, you know, 6 o'clock, and real forlorn. So upset that people had left him and they wouldn't work that other night. You know, he wanted to work 7 nights a week and Saturday and Sunday if he could.
You got paid for this, I hope.
No, that was my other problem. I remember that particular year when I got promoted to manager, I didn't get paid overtime.
No.
And I put over 950 hours overtime that year and just lost. Just
completely gone.
I made less that year than I did 5 years previous. So, but he was really so devoted, you know, you couldn't help but get caught up in his enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And except that he demanded so many, you know, we used to do 5 or 6 proposals of one thing. You know, it might be a body side molding. You know, you'd have to, there was just too much,
mm-hmm.
too much work.
Very intense.
And I remember the first week, now I walked in there to this production studio, Jim Sipple just left. He went to another studio. He had the job before I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what was going on. You know, I saw some wooden moldings on a table and some parts here or there. I had no idea what was happening. What was happening was, it was supposed to be the final approval of ornamentation on the Ford car line for 1966. So we get in the showroom and it was just bedlam. It was terrible. The head, let's see, was Don Fry,
uh-huh.
was head of Ford division at that time. And he and Joe just went round and round on this ornamentation, and it was to a point where even Don Fry went up and was relocating lettering on a car, which a guy in that position should never do. And this meeting went on till about 6 o'clock at night, I think, and it was just a terrible meeting. And everybody left except Joe and a young assistant I had. And Joe sits me down and he says, this has been one of the worst days of my life. He says, next week we have to go for final approval on the ornamentation on this car and all its series. If you don't come up with the best ornamentation I've ever seen, you and I are both going to Siberia.
So, what was Siberia in those days?
Hmm?
What was Siberia?
Russia.
I know, but I, not another part of the...
Oh, no, 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 that's what he meant. You would just go to Siberia, yeah. You know, both of us. So this young fellow was taking notes like crazy, my young assistant. And I spent all day Sunday working up an ornamentation plan at home. And I had all my notes, and I had this young fellow's notes. And I'm reading through his notes, and at the bottom it says, "Only God can save us now."
That's marvelous. Who was this young man?
Chris Miller.
He's still around?
No, he went to California, became a graphic designer.
Oh, yeah.
So that was, that just broke me up.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, it worked out okay. We did sell our invitation finally, and once I got...
Who would you be selling it to?
Well, that'd be pretty high. Don Fry, I think, was general manager of Ford Division then.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I take it he didn't like it the previous Friday, obviously.
Right.
And
yeah.
Was very vocal about
mm-hmm.
it. Yeah. And Joe was equally adamant. Perhaps.
Yep, and I just got caught up in all this. My poor, innocent, brand new manager. So then, I get beckoned one day to go over to World Headquarters for an interview for some kind of a new job.
This is the mid
60s? Yeah, this was 1965. I went over to World Headquarters and met this gentleman named Paul Burns, and I spent about 3 hours in his office.
I know Paul.
Do you know Paul?
Public relations?
Yep,
type? Yeah.
Super guy. Super.
We worked for him with the archives back in the 60s.
Did you?
Yeah.
I thought Paul was just a dear.
Yeah, he was.
Well, finally, after the 3 hours, I realized this was a whole new department called Corporate Identity. And that Mr. Ford wanted to do something about the identity of the company. At that time, of course, corporate identity programs were quite popular.
Mm-hmm.
Most large companies were getting into it.
Right.
And Mr. Ford felt we had some problems. So I interviewed for the job, and I got it. And I was promoted again then to corporate design manager. And went over there and just had a small, they weren't even set up yet. And I had to just set up a whole department. I had a order supplies, get designers, the whole bit. But as it evolved, I found out that really they didn't want me or my people to do the designing. They wanted some famous outside firm. The first thing was the Ford trademark. I thought, what can we do with the Ford trademark? So they got hold of Paul Rand, who's a famous graphic designer. I think he's in Connecticut. He's designed the Westinghouse symbol you see on television and so on. And he worked for I don't know how many months. As manager, he wouldn't even allow me to go into his shop. I couldn't visit. I wasn't allowed to see anything he was doing.
Came out here to Dearborn?
Yeah, he would come out here now and then, with the development of his work. He kept his place in Connecticut, but I couldn't go out there.
Mm.
He didn't want anything to do with me. Well, anyway, he finally came up with his proposal, and it was in a book form, a thick book. History of the trademark, why he felt it should change, why he felt his design was the right design for Ford, and so on. And Mr. Mecky, Ted Mecky, was right. Vice President of Public Relations then.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a quandary as how to present this to Mr. Ford, formally or informally.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, Mr. Ford used to come into Ted's office and,
sure.
and chit-chat.
Yeah.
So he decided just to leave this book on his conference table.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Ford came in one day, and then Ted was able to casually bring him through it. Mr. Ford would have no part of it. He said, there's nothing wrong with the trademark of this company.
What had Rand
well,
proposed?
He had come up with, he kept the blue background
yes.
and the white lettering,
mm-hmm.
but it was completely restyled, and he did it in the form of a racetrack. He took the capital Ford F, brought it down and around into a racetrack shape. Well, it looked like a Luden's cough drop to me. And Mr. Ford rejected it, and I was quite happy about that. Then I got a few people of my own, and one of my designers, Hank Fine, who came from Lippin Cotton Margulies, who worked on the Chrysler corporate identity program, was a very good graphic designer. He's still with the company.
He's still around.
Yes, Hank's still around. And Bobby says, we have to do something with that trademark. You know, the lettering isn't quite right. The Ford oval isn't proportioned exactly right. I said, yeah, but you know what happened. Mr. Ford rejected Rand's proposal. Well, he says, I don't mean anything that radical. Just kind of tune it up, clean it up. So he and I worked on that for a long time. We finally got it to where we thought it was the right proportion. Everything was just right about it. And we went to Ted Mecky with it. Of course, Ted Mecky was reluctant to approach Mr. Ford again on the trademark.
I know, yeah.
But he did, and Mr. Ford had no problem.
Good.
Because we showed him how we could reduce the trademark quite small and still it, you could read it, whereas the old one you couldn't. So we were able to make that refinement on the trademark.
Good.
Then we got Unimark. Unimark was a design firm in Chicago.
You kept the script, as I recall.
We kept the script.
Which is a good idea.
Right. Yeah. We just modified it so it would print properly, read properly.
A little less archaic. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that Mr. Ford accepted. Unimark, let's see, Ralph Eckerstrom was the head of Unimark in Chicago, and we selected him to do our major design work, stationery and so on. And he established offices in Southfield here, staffed it with a design director and people and so on. And that was rather stormy. You know, we industrial designers regard automotive designers with contempt.
Do they?
Yeah. Yeah. We're not designers in their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is unfortunate because I tend to think they're a little bit blue sky in their thinking. They don't really get down to the nitty gritty as we do. So there was friction there. There were problems with me as design manager working with them.
Mm-hmm.
But we overcame it. I finally couldn't get along with one design director, and they had to put in another one. And he was better.
What was the name of the firm again?
Unimark.
Unimark.
And Ralph Eckerstrom was head of it.
Eckerstrom.
Eckerstrom.
Well-known in the field.
Yeah, quite well-known, yeah, in the graphics field. I think he redid the American Airlines identification that you see today. That is theirs. They've done a lot of big...
Did you and Hank Fine come up with that sans serif modern block? Quite a bit in terms of signing.
Helvetica.
Yes, right.
Helvetica typeface.
Right.
I'm not sure. No, I think Unimark recommended that.
Oh, did they?
And of course, Hank supported it because at that time, Helvetica was a very popular typeface, very readable. And that is what went on the signage. They did the major portion of the company signage.
Mm-hmm.
We did, my people did the dealer signage.
Did you?
The Ford and Lincoln Mercury signs that you see now at dealers, the bands that go around the building.
Yes.
That was all ours.
That was good.
And we were proud to be able to do that internally. I don't know why the company felt an outside design firm was important unless they felt that only an outside design firm could do the job properly. It was a big job. We couldn't have done it all alone, that's true.
It's that old prejudice of... For big jobs, you go outside.
Yeah. But we had a sign farm in back of Row headquarters. I don't know if you remember seeing that or not.
A
sign farm, as we called it. It was, we built these mock dealerships. We actually built the buildings, put the signs up. We had the big truck sign. We had the Lincoln Mercury sign, the Ford sign. And
I was waiting for it in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I missed that.
So you missed it. Well, this sign farm was interesting because we used to have many reviews out there. Mr. Ford used
right.
to come out. Lee Iacocca came out.
Right.
And we used to have night reviews to see how the signs look at
sure.
night.
Uh-huh.
And one night, Lee Iacocca came out after a ball game, a Tigers ball game.
Yeah.
And it was a hot night. We had some beer there, and he had a beer with us, walking around with a can of beer looking at these signs. He was super.
That's great, yeah.
But there was a dispute, as I remember, let's see, Ford was the corporate blue, or lighter blue, a little lighter than the corporate.
Yeah.
And Lincoln Mercury is red and black. Mercury's on a red background, and Lincoln's on a black. And for some reason, and again, this was Don Fry, he wanted the red for Ford, and not this lighter shade of blue. And there was a big dispute there between Lincoln Mercury and Ford division. Which finally got straightened out.
Yeah, you kept the corporate blue. Yeah.
Kept the blue.
Good decision.
Yeah. Well, we had the corporate blue, of course, was in the Ford
the
oval portion of the sign,
and
a lighter blue behind the Ford.
That's right, yeah. It was slightly lighter. Yeah.
Yeah.
Red wouldn't have been, I think.
Wouldn't have been, yeah. I can't remember why he wanted red at that time, but anyway, that finally got settled. But there was a lot of things like that.
At this point, were you involved with the early 60s? Were you involved with the Mustang, though?
No, because the Mustang was being done while I was in corporate identity.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
But
again, with the corporate identity, this painting you have in the wall reminds me, you know, the ore bolts.
Yes.
Mr. Ford decided that, well, you know, we got to do the ore bolts too. So we came up with many proposals of how we could identify the ore bolts.
Uh-huh.
We had corporate blue hulls, if you can believe, some proposals.
Yeah.
A lot of different schemes. And we had to go over to see this Mr. Kahn, who was head of steel division at the time, Paul Burns and myself. And they knew what we were up to, and they didn't want to bother with us. But we went over there to the steel division one day, and Mr. Kahn was having a meeting with his staff, and it was a huge office, and his desk was right in the middle of this office. and it reminded me of Mafia Don.
Or a movie mogul.
Yeah, and he kept us waiting about an hour anyway, and he finally called us in, and all his people are sitting around the wall in chairs. "Well, Mr. Burns," he said, "I understand you have some proposals here to paint the Orbos. Gentlemen, this is Mr. Burns, Mr. Zokas. I don't know what they're up to, but let's see what they have here." So I get out these renderings and start going through it. And all these snickers and laughs, and oh, it was terrible. It was just a terrible meeting. I wanted to get out of there so bad. And this con just ridiculed us something terrible. And he says, "I suggest to you that you go on board one of these Orbos. You talk to one of my people, and they'll tell you what the problems are with what you're proposing here." So I did. I contacted this fellow. I forget his name now. He's manager. He was manager of the Orbos at the time. And he took me aboard, and he pointed out all the problems they have with these boats. The reason they're painted black, the hulls, it's a very inexpensive paint. And the paint is scraped off constantly by ice and so on, and they can't use an expensive paint because they just roll this paint out with huge rollers, and it's a very inexpensive property. And then he said, "Well," he says, "you can't, we can't paint the smokestack in this, Mr. Ford has always wanted this tan and black." And I didn't know, I thought he was talking about Henry Ford II.
No.
It turned out he was talking about Henry Ford I. So anyway, we weren't getting anywhere with this steel division at all. And one day, Ted Mickey was going to New York with Mr. Ford, flying to New York. And Mr. Ford says, "Well, Ted, how's the corporate identity program going?" Ted says, "Well, going quite well, but we're having a little trouble with the Orbos." He says, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, they don't want them touched." "Oh, is that so?" Well, the very next day, we get a call, "Come down, do anything you want,"
yes.
Anything. The door was open. Mr. Kahn got the word. So, but still, listening to them, you know, within reason, we didn't do anything ridiculous. We just went to this blue smokestack.
Very tasteful, isn't it?
Yeah, and at that time, it was just the blue smokestack and had the white Ford Oval on it. And then one of the captains started complaining. They said that everybody else on the lakes is laughing at him with his blue smokestack. And one of the fellows, a crew member of one of the boats, sent in a suggestion. He says, "I've been really studying this blue smokestack at Ford Oval." And he says,
"Why?" Lake Superior.
Yeah. And he says, "Why don't you put on a white stripe around the funnel?" And he was thinking in terms of racing stripe. Remember the GT Mustangs and so on had racing stripes. What an idea. That did it. Just putting that white band, that did it. The captains were happy. Everybody was happy. The young fellow got an award for a suggestion.
Good.
And we were happy. So,
right. But you've kept that to this day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The ore boats are still that way.
It's very, very good-looking boats.
So yeah.
I think you're proud of them.
But the whole corporate identity program was a hassle.
Endless hassle.
And if we didn't have Mr. Ford backing us, never would have happened. People just resist change. They just don't. They don't understand. They don't want anything to do with it. They talk about signs. Don't talk to me about signs. I got a business to run here. I got a plant to operate.
Right.
It was a constant battle.
It must have been.
The first sign we put up out in Troy, at the tractor facility.
Yeah.
If you've been up that way, if you notice, there's residential homes across the street.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we went up one night to see this sign lit for the first time. And we were all out there admiring the sign. Well, this woman came charging across the street, and she was so mad. She says, "What do you mean by lighting up this Christmas tree like this? You know, don't you know there are houses across the street, and now you got the..." Oh, boy, she just had a fit. Terrible. I think they put the... They didn't like that sign then. They left it unlit just because of that.
A long time.
Yeah, because of the residential homes.
Yeah.
Oh, she had a fit.
As I remember, the tractors had kept the old oval quite religiously.
Yes, they did.
Yeah, it was one of the few parts of the company that still kept the oval.
Correct, yeah.
I'm glad you kept it because it gives a sense of continuity,
mm-hmm.
a sense of history.
That's right. Now we put the Ford Oval on the Ford cars, if
I
you notice. That.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
Europe started doing that. They started using the oval first. But of course, Europe didn't have the Lincoln Mercury Ford division problem. It was just one car.
Right.
You know, we've used the oval on the trucks, too, for years.
Oh, of course, yeah. Right.
But it was just recently that decided, well, Ford division cars should have the Ford oval on it.
You started with the Escort, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Second year.
Right. Lincoln Mercury, it's tougher to do.
Yeah.
You put it on the scuff plate or someplace as product of Ford Motor Company. So that was kind of corporate identity.
That went very well.
That was very, very interesting.
Your work to survive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good.
Then I came back. Well, I had read a blue letter one day. I was still manager of the corporate identity office, and I saw that Don Kopka had been promoted from design exec to director. And I just going through my mind, gee, I wonder who's going to get the promotion to design exec to fill his spot. Well, it turned out to be me. They called me, and Gene Bordenay had told me, your umbilical cord is never severed. You're always part of us. Remember that.
That's good.
So he was true to his word and called me back, and I started with the trim and color department at Ford.
This was in, was this the interior design?
Yeah, I didn't have the interior studios. At that time, well, they still do. They have an exec in charge of just trim and color,
uh-huh.
A design exec, with a director over trim and color and interiors.
But you were the design executive then?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You actually did most of the work then, pretty much.
For trim and color?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was under Don Kopka. Gene Bordenay, of course, was the vice president.
How was it to work for Kopka? Was he
he's a super guy. Mm-hmm. Don Kopka is just great. Never a problem with him. Usually anything you want to do, fine, go ahead, it looks great. I like it. Let's do it. I mean, it's a very positive attitude. It's he leaves you alone pretty much. Yeah. Good man. And I wasn't there too long. Let's see, how long was I in that? Only till February of 69 from August. So from there I went, was transferred to Ford Design Office, Exterior Studios.
When you were in interior design, what model did you work on, do you remember?
Well, pretty much, there was fabrics and paints,
mm-hmm.
and well, it had to be the 1969, 70.
Did you enjoy working with fabrics and paints?
It was interesting, but no, I still think my main interest is in exterior design.
Right.
Yeah. Because what happened in trim and color, you're really at the end of the tube. And by that I mean interiors selects fabrics for their seats and for their door panels.
Yeah.
They select paints. Paints had to be sent to Florida and fade tested for a period of time. All the fabrics had to be tested by our labs for durability and flame proof and so on. Well, that's fine as long as you follow the normal timing pattern. But what happens because of competitive actions or whatever they may be, you end up changing fabrics or changing colors.
Mm-hmm.
Then this makes the whole system late. And the final tube is trim and color. They've got to get everything out in what they call 446 charts, where it shows all the combinations of colors that you can get, the tape stripes and the vinyl roofs and the interior colors.
Mm-hmm.
So it puts a terrific burden on them. So there you always have this time pressure on you. People are always calling and saying, well, you're late, you've got to get this out. And it's a very complex area, trim and color.
You're the last on the
from the design center to
right.
get out into the system.
Uh-huh. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I hadn't realized that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, color and trim, that's always the last.
We had a gentleman in here who worked in color and trim for many years. I'm trying to come up with his name. He enjoyed the work, he said. He worked for many years with suppliers, and
mm-hmm.
he was at the other end, I think. You were at the design end. He was the guy who did the actual executing the work with the suppliers.
Mm-hmm.
Would that have been Herb Bibby?
I don't think so, no.
I forgot who it was, but he gave us a very interesting overview of the work, presumably. He took over where you left off. He, once the designs were executed and approved, then he had, his job was to...
Was it Jimmy Hodum?
Jimmy Hodum, yes.
Oh, Jimmy. Jimmy just retired.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Yeah, Jimmy had worked for me at the time.
Right, and he told about working with you and others, that he would go to the suppliers. And,
yes, he did.
And
yeah,
actually execute
yeah.
the...
See, I was in charge of the overall department. He had fabrics. Herman Brunn
right.
had paints and color. So I didn't... They tried to involve me with the suppliers, and I didn't care for that end of it. I wanted to stay away. I wanted them to deal with them, but I not to be aloof or anything, but I felt if we were going to have a problem, then I could confront the vendor with the problem.
Mm-hmm.
if I got too chummy going to lunch every day, I didn't think that was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
So I stayed away from that.
Probably a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. So it was exacting work and many minute details.
Oh yeah, that is really complex. You know, yeah. I mentioned how interiors was complex. The trim and color that is a bucket of worms. Because
Jim Hodum did say that it was very exacting work.
Yeah.
But he seemed to enjoy it.
Oh, he did. Yeah. He thrived on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of them did. A lot of them were professionals and good for that field. I was a designer.
Right. Yeah.
And I felt I wanted to design cars. I didn't want to fool around with colored chips and fabric.
Right.
So, but they felt it was important to have a designer up there to keep an eye on the design aspects of color
right.
and fabric.
Yes. Were women coming into this aspect of design at this point?
Not at that point. They came in later.
And women were always perceived as being have a very acute sense of color.
Yeah, and that has worked out very well.
Has it?
Yeah. They did have one girl back in the 60s, and she even wove her own fabric and so on. She was a real fabric designer.
Uh-huh.
And then she left, and there was a period there where we had no women. And now I think there's about four or five of them up there. Jimmy might have told you exactly how many.
Yeah.
And they that's a very valuable asset. Very important to have women in color and trim.
Right.
Absolutely. So let's see.
So you graduated, you've been promoted to the exteriors now.
Yeah. And that was a promotion from the corporate identity office.
And working with whom at this point?
At that point, I worked. Went to at the Ford Exterior Studio, working for Dave Ash. Dave Ash was the director. And at that time, I worked on the 1971 and 72 Torino. The 72 Torino being the all-new body for that year, and that was quite exciting to work on that project. This was also the Bunky Knudsen era.
Ah, can you expound on that a bit?
Well, a little bit. You know, Bunky used to like to have what we called his dawn patrols. And that would be a review for him in the morning, like 7:30 in the morning.
Uh-huh.
Well, it meant our setup people, our millwrights, and the people that set up the shows had to get up around 3 or 4 in the morning, get in around 5 to set the show up in the courtyard for Bunky.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite interesting because he also brought in this Larry Shinoda from General Motors, who I believe did the Corvette, one of the models, one Corvette. And Bunky gave him a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
And he really had Bunky's ear. We hear he used to have breakfast with Bunky before they came over to the design center.
Right.
Larry ignored Jean Bordenay, wouldn't listen to him, didn't care what he said or anything else. And we'd be in the courtyard with Jean and the rest of us waiting. Larry would be at the lobby doors waiting for Bunky to clue him in on what he's going to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then he'd bring him around. And Gene was just standing there. You know, it was really a very, very sad thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Larry moved up too fast. He didn't know how to act as a manager level. And he
didn't care.
Yeah. And he just wielded an iron fist. I mean, he just told people he was going to do this and do that, and he just ran rampant through the building.
Mm-hmm.
And Gene, there was no control that Gene could put on him because of his connection with Bunky. Bunky was a very good, he had a very good eye for design.
Newton had just recently been appointed
president of the company.
Of Ford Motor Company.
Yeah, I think that was happened about 69.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
And Bunky would go around to the designer's drawing boards, see a sketch he liked, and just say, well, let's do that, we'll do that.
Unheard of,
absolutely. But the 71 Ford came out of that, 72 Thunderbird, 72 Mark, under the Knudsen era.
Uh-huh.
Very nice cars.
Uh-huh.
He always said that our cars were only 80% complete. Ford Motor Company cars were 80% complete.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what he meant by that was that we didn't have the finished detailing that General Motors cars have.
Mm-hmm.
And he would look, for instance, at a Mercury door trim panel and say, why is this Mylar? Mylar is just the plastic.
Right.
He used die casting. He would change a program right when it was running out of time. There was no time to do anything. He said, this should be die casting. Well, he was right. Everything he said was right. But Ford is not General Motors. You know, a lot of things we just can't afford to do.
Mm-hmm.
but I think he really exercised quite an influence in that era.
Were those the early 70s cars big sellers?
Yes.
Were they design-wise, were they fairly good-looking?
Absolutely, uh-huh. Yeah. The Torino, for instance, now this is when we felt something was going on, because we'd have a show set up in a courtyard, I remember the Torino specifically, and Lee Iacocca would come over with his group and go through these cars, then leave, then Knutson would come over. Mm-hmm. So the two of them obviously weren't together.
On the same wavelength.
No, not at all.
So, in terms of decision-making, of course, but Bunky had the final vote.
Well, he did. He was president.
Final to say, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But I guess Lee would just want to see what was going on, or exert whatever influence he could, which he finally did.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. So that was an interesting era. And at that time, I did have the Torino car line, and I was happy to work on the 72 because it was all new. After that,
whose design was the Torino?
The original design came from the Special Projects or Advanced Group, mm-hmm. and that was Ken Spencer and Bill Kramer worked on that car. Mm-hmm. Then it was transferred to us in the production. The design came from the Special Projects or Advanced Group, mm-hmm. and that was Ken Spencer and Bill Kramer worked on that car. Mm-hmm. Then it was transferred to us in the production studio. So mm-hmm. this is the car now. You work out the grills, taillights, and mm-hmm. the ornamentation and so on. They just do the basic shape. Mm-hmm. So, and then in those days, competition was so strong that they're always afraid that the studio that had to pick up this car line would change it. And this usually happened.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The people in the studio that inherited somebody else's design would try to make a change in the car so they could say it's theirs. You know. Uh-huh. And I decided not to do that. I thought, well, that isn't, you know, the car is very nice. It's a good-looking car. I'm going to stick as closely as I can to the original design. And I know I was being watched very closely on that by Bourdonnais. Uh-huh. And he'd come in every day and check the car, check the drawings, because I think they suspected we were probably going to monkey with it. Uh-huh. We never did. The car stayed.
Is that called tampering with the package?
Not the package. No, you couldn't tamper with the package, but you tamper with the design.
Okay.
You might say, well, this line looks a little soft here. I'm going to sharpen that up a bit. Mm-hmm. I think I'll raise the deck a little bit. Mm-hmm. Those are the things they watch for. See, Joe Orris was famous for that. He would never accept somebody else's design. He always had a monkey with it a little bit to make it his own.
When did Orris leave? Do you remember
I think it was... it was around 1974.
Oh, so he's still pretty much at Ford Design Studio at this point.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, at that time, I think he went to Europe. Yeah, because I had just gotten out of the trim and color department, went to work for Dave Ash, and that's when Joe Orris was sent to Europe.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
At that point, he was probably one of the first to be sent there, wasn't he?
No, Roy Brown was
Roy Brown
the first.
There.
Yeah.
That's right. Oh, that's right.
Yeah, he was the first.
But even so, this is still a fairly new assignment for senior stylists.
That's right.
That, yeah.
It was very new.
Was it considered in the 60s to be a plum assignment? Or was it thought that it was otherwise?
I think...
I know Roy considered it.
Yeah, I think it definitely would be. I'm thinking about my own situation. I think in the 60s, 70s, back then it was almost as if, well, you've got to go to Europe if you want to get anywhere
right,
in the company.
It's part of your career development.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Damon Woods, I think, went after Roy Brown. Mm-hmm. And then I think it was Damon Woods was killed by a Karen Automobile accident. Yeah. And then I can't remember who went after Damon. It might have been Joe. Yeah, I think it was Joe. Joe was next.
Sir, you're being moved around quite a bit.
Oh boy, did I move.
Yeah. And you're in, at this point in the early 70s, you've got a new assignment.
Mm-hmm. And this assignment was Special Vehicle Safety Design. Now this was a rough... No, this was, 1974 designers. Yeah, then I worked for Don Della Rosa. He was the executive director. John Najar was director. and then director for the safety studio was Dave Wheeler. Dave Wheeler also came from General Motors during the Knudsen era.
Ah.
Dave thought he wasn't going to survive either, because Larry Shinoda didn't, but Dave was a different type of person. Uh-huh. He's no problem with Dave.
Uh-huh.
He's still with us, as a matter of fact. He has trim and color now.
Does he? Now, this is the what segment of...
Well, they call it Special Vehicles Safety Design. Now, this would be like around from 1970 to 73.
Mm-hmm.
And...
You'd worked a few months before in Special Vehicles.
I did, yeah. Uh-huh. This is a hazy period because I was moved around quite a bit. The design, the Special Vehicles and Industrial Design Office was under Johnny Najjar.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were getting into, we were becoming very safety conscious because the government
right.
was after us.
Right.
So we reorganized that studio and it became a Vehicle Safety Design and Special Vehicles Office.
You switched the emphasis.
Yeah, we switched the emphasis. And in that studio, we worked on safety related items, visibility, anything the government had on the docket as a possible ruling for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And we would take those things and then experiment with them and work them out, see what effect they had on the cars.
Mm-hmm.
They had one visibility ruling that was, we knew was just impossible to execute in a production car. So we took, at that time it was a 1971 Ford convertible, took the roof off, and then we modeled a roof to meet the specifications of this government request, and cast the roof and put it on this convertible, married it into the convertible so we could drive the car.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you had visibility, but you sure wouldn't like the car.
Mm-hmm.
And because of their up-angle requirement from looking through the rearview mirror, a station wagon would have to be about 10 feet high at the rear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was that kind of thing. And then we'd invite these people from the government in and show them, say, this is the effect your law would have on our programs.
What department of the government was this?
It was National Highway Traffic Safety.
Traffic Safety.
NHTSA. Yeah.
Perhaps you could pause a moment and give us a sort of a bird's eye view of the difficulties, difficulties in working with these mandated or safety requirements of the government.
Well, it was very difficult because this one rule. I met the fellow from the government. His previous job had been head of a fleet of trucks for the. Forestry rangers. Well, that's how much he knew about engineering and safety and so on. And he just, I hadn't visited his office in Washington, but somebody else did. And he was doing everything with just a wooden ruler, you know, like a grammar school ruler. That's what his tools of the trade were.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the kind of mentality you were dealing with. And it was very frustrating, really, because some of the rulings were just ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. And they had no sympathy or feeling whatsoever for the implications of the auto industry, what this would cost the buyer of the car or the manufacturer. They're a lot better now, I think. I think we have a better...
More sophisticated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think we have better communications with them now than we did then. We didn't know how to deal with them then.
Mm-hmm.
I also worked on a safety car. We actually built a safety car and crashed it. And I guess I wasn't out at the crash test, but I understand it was quite successful. And we designed the whole thing based on a Ford Galaxy car and just built it up for the government. It was for them. You know, they were all there, witnessed the crash and so on.
What features were built into that design, that safety car that you didn't have on the current models?
Well, we had, it was heavily padded on the interior.
Mm-hmm.
The instrument panel, the seats, the door trim panels, the head lining, and...
Some provision for the steering wheel column.
Yes, we did that too, and then also added structure in the front end for crash, for higher than a 5 mile an hour crash, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I forget, I think it was maybe 30 mile an hour crash at that time. They had to withstand. The occupants had to survive.
Right. 5 miles an hour always seemed a bit unrealistic to me.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was mainly for the insurance companies that pushed that.
Yeah. Yeah,
because they claimed that most of the damage was done around 3 miles an hour in parking lots. And
surveys or studies have shown them.
Yeah, so that's why they got that going, because they were damaging sheet metal and grills and taillights. So they come up with this 5 mile an hour bumper. And the only thing they never said was, what happens to the car when it gets hit at 10 miles an hour? Then the cost to the insurance company or the owner is a lot greater. There's a lot of sophisticated pistons there that support that bumper and so on. And when they're all destroyed, then it costs a lot of money to replace.
But the government was really interested in the occupant safety.
Right, yeah, that was the main thing.
And so you had this tug of war between costs and design and the need for protecting the passengers,
right,
the driver and the passenger. Mm-hmm.
So this studio was mainly to experiment and explore some of the rulings that the government was coming up with. Mm-hmm. So it gave management an opportunity to see the implications on the product. Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting project to work on, but frustrating
to make,
too.
Frustrating, yes. Were you able to make any headway in terms of compatible safety features?
Well, that one with this ridiculous vision ruling that they had, that went away. Uh-huh. Once they saw what it did to the car, they backed off that one. Especially the effect on a station wagon.
I remember in 65 that just about the time you came, Ford was coming out with a safety package for the 56
right.
model,
mm-hmm.
and quite visionary at the time.
You bet.
And unfortunately, somewhere along the line, either there was a less than public acceptance, enthusiastic public acceptance, and the company backed off for a few years.
That's true. In 56, Ford was pushing safety.
Right.
And Chevrolet was saying the hot one's even hotter.
Right.
And that's what sold.
Yeah.
You know, nobody was interested in safety.
I was too. I bought a 55 Ford, and I just missed the safety package. I'm not sure whether it was compatible, if I could have gotten it. But mm-hmm. I didn't get seatbelts until 1960, and then I realized that I had to have them. Mm-hmm.
I was putting seat belts in my cars, every car I got, I put them in even before they were standard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
Ford was certainly a pioneer.
But Ford never gave up on it. You know, we still continued the safety.
Right, yeah.
Just didn't advertise it that much. So that was the safety studio.
Was it successful, do you feel?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, it was something that was needed for that period.
Mm-hmm.
And then it went away. So let's see from there. It was quite a track to follow here.
You're moving back into the Ford studios at this point, in the early 70s.
Oh, yes.
Was that a deliberate move? Was there a special assignment there?
Right, the early 70s. Where's the safety? Safety design.
73, 74.
Oh, yeah, Ford 73 to 74. Ford studio. Okay, yeah, that was, I went back into that studio and worked on the 75 Granada, the Monarch, and the Mustang, and the Pinto.
Oh,
75 Granada was all new. Yeah. And
whose design was that, do you remember?
Yeah. I think...
Besides yours, of course.
I don't know. The original design might have come out of De La Rosa's advanced studio, I think. I'm not sure, because... When I went into the studio, it was at the stage for grills, ornamentation, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember just who did the car originally.
A good, successful design.
Yeah. And 73 to 76. Yeah, here's where I moved around quite a bit. I was from the vehicle safety to Ford studio, international special vehicles. And anyway, those periods where I was in this special vehicles, adjusted design office, or international special vehicles, basically that was an advanced studio.
Mm-hmm. That must have been fun.
And that was, because we did all the family cars as well as show cars. We did all the show cars.
Uh-huh.
And at that time we had, it was called Carcraft. Carcraft was a car builder.
Yes.
Which was captive to Ford. They only worked on Ford items. And Mike Alexander, who's now out at Sunroof, he ran the place for us.
Ah, uh-huh.
And
they did your special show cars.
All the show cars. We had the
show cars. Remember from that period.
There was a '71 Thunderbird. We called the Trident, T-R-I-D-O-N, and that was an exciting white vehicle. And God, I remember he had a very unusual lighting on it and so on. There was the Explorer. The Explorer was kind of a truck, an open bed truck vehicle. Uh-huh. It was a forward cab.
Uh-huh.
A Maverick LDO, which was a luxury Maverick.
Uh-huh. Did that ever come off?
No. Well, no. The Maverick LDO did, yeah.
Oh, did it?
The LDO became a production car.
Did it?
That car, what did we do to it? It was basically a four-door sedan, but we put a window in the rear pillar,
mm-hmm.
so it became what we call a six-light.
Mm-hmm.
And it was painted a pearlescent white. It had all special bright moldings on it, special wheels and tires, and a special interior. The interior was an unusual Soul style,
uh-huh.
the door trim and the Soul style.
What was the stock on?
LDO, luxury.
No, the Soul style, the interior you were talking about. Did you say Soul style?
Soul style.
What is that?
That's the pattern or the design of the seats.
I see. Oh, it's digital.
And the door trim panels, yeah.
Okay.
Well, Iacocca saw the car. De La Rosa presented it to him, and he says, build it. Let's build it. Let's make a special series of the Maverick.
Uh-huh.
So they pushed that through the system.
Uh-huh.
And he said, build it just like that. Well, the engineers just went crazy because we had brass chrome-plated moldings. We had chrome-plated door lock buttons. You know, there were things you just couldn't do in production. It had a pearlescent paint. Now, a pearlescent paint you just can't do in production.
Production line, yeah.
But because Iacocca said, do it that way, the system was pressured so badly.
Mm-hmm.
But they finally come up with a cost of doing it his way, and finally they backed off. And although it did get I think it was a special white paint they put in the system,
mm-hmm.
not unusual, not certainly pearlescent, but something close. But the interior trim and so on, they it was just pretty much the way
he
designed
the
car. Yeah,
the LDO.
Mm-hmm. Became a very successful car.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a Maverick Estate car. That was another show car. It was just an unusual, kind of a luxurious, something to do with the Maverick and make it luxurious.
Wasn't a station wagon?
No. Mm-hmm. No, it had a very wide C-pillar, a closed-in look, a very private, personal kind of car.
Uh-huh.
Actually, it was a roof similar to the original 39 Continental.
Oh, yes.
That
we
put on it.
Uh-huh.
And it even had a little bustle back trunk
uh-huh.
with straps on it.
Whatever happened to it?
I don't know. I don't know. They probably got
a warehouse
crunched.
Somewhere where all these show cars are stacked away.
Well, the guy that contacted over there is Tom Land.
Yeah, I've talked to Tom.
Tom really has
yeah. He's got a handle on most of it.
And he worked with me on most of these things.
Did he, really?
Back then, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then we did the Sportiva and the Sports Hauler. The Sports Hauler I mentioned to you before, Sportiva was a Pinto, a little, almost, you know, similar to the EXP is today. We made a little two-passenger coupe out of the Pinto. It was really cute. So that was just some of the show cars that were done at that time. Family cars we did. We did a special Pinto for Mr. Ford. And, of course, he loved the candy apple maroon.
Mm-hmm.
All those cars had to be a special candy. There's many shades of candy apple, but this had to be a certain one.
Uh-huh.
And we had an outside supplier build it who really didn't know what he was doing. And Tom Land and I remember spent the whole weekend out there all night. We spent all night Sunday night. I called De La Rosa in the morning about 9 o'clock and I said, well, I think the car is finished. This guy had a bucket of bolts he brought from his father's garage and dumped them on the floor looking for nuts and bolts to put the car together. And I says, where are the nuts and bolts you took off the car? And he wanted black windshield wiper arms. And no, he just had a spray can. He sprayed the way. And I says, that isn't going to work. I says, the paint's going to peel off. Tom and I were just having
delivered that day. Huh?
Yeah, the next day it had to be delivered.
Mm-hmm.
And the seal on the back third door, I don't know what they did. They lost it or something, and it wouldn't fit, or the door wouldn't shut. This fellow's out in the parking lot at 3 o'clock in the morning pulling the seal off his Chrysler Newport to see if he can make that work.
And this wasn't car craft.
No, not at all. No, this was another supplier. And Tom and I were just beside ourselves. You know, we didn't know what to do outside of build it ourselves.
Yeah.
Now the car was delivered, but it had to be gone over again in our own, you know, back here at Ford.
Yeah, right.
We had to send it over the experimental garage here and get it properly fixed. What a nightmare.
It must be.
And then they came in with this markup, you know, they wanted much more money because of all the time they spent in the car, but that was another hassle after that.
Mm.
It really wasn't a pleasant experience, not that one. There's been others that have been a lot better.
Henry Ford II liked the Pinto, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did. Yeah. He liked that car so well that he asked us to build another one just like it, because the Shah, of course, the Shah of Iran was a friend of his. Mm-hmm. The Shah liked it so well that we built one for the Shah.
Great.
And then engineering had to really work on the car because of the heat over there in Iran. They had to make sure the car would cool properly, so they did special things with radiators and so on. But the Shah had one just like Henry's at that time. Yeah, exactly. It was a duplicate. Duplicate car.
Marvelous.
Yeah.
It's been great fun.
It was. It was quite an experience.
Sort of an interesting interlude for you to work on.
Yeah, to go from the production studios to this, you know, it was good. And now then.
Now you're back on the line, so to speak.
Where am I?
Compact cars and intermediate car interiors, 75, 76.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why we already talked about that as far as the Granada Monarch, Mustang, Pinto, and so on. Yeah. Then I'm back into International Special Vehicles and Advanced Concepts. That's 76. Just for a short time there.
You were needed in several different places in the 70s.
At that time, I worked for Della Rosa. Della Rosa would always seem to get me back into his camp. That's why I'm having a hard time here, David, because it's all very hazy. I was back and forth almost doing the same thing for a number of years.
Don enjoyed working with you and your special talents in these special vehicles, advanced vehicles.
I get the feeling that he did, yeah. Which I was flattered by, and I appreciated that. I think really the biggie now, the next one to go on to, is the Light Car Exterior Design Office.
And what's coming from, up in that? In
that was from 76 to 78. Because the biggie there was I was promoted to director. And in the spring of 76, they decided to bring Jack Telnak back from Europe. Jack was vice president of design for Europe.
Had he succeeded whom over there?
Joe Orris.
Joe Orris, right.
And he had done a fine job on the Fiesta.
Ah, yes.
That was Jack's car.
Ford's favorite car.
Right. And also, he did a fine job on facelifting the European Granada.
Ah.
So Jack was a fair-haired boy, you know, and Mr. Ford thought a lot of him. So Gene had to bring him back. And I didn't know this, but I got a call from Jack one day from Europe. Mm-hmm. And he said, Bobby, I want you to recommend to me some managers that we could have in this department I'm going to run and some designers. And I said, what are you talking about? Well, he says, I'm coming back and I want you as my exec. I said, well, gee, that's pretty flattering. He says, yeah. He says, I talked to Gene Bourdain. I said, that's the way it's going to be. I want Bob Zokas as my exec. I said, well, gee, thanks, Jack. That's great.
Had you worked with Jack previously?
Yeah.
In what segment?
Well, Jack, actually, he worked for me back when I had Ford Pre-Productions, back in 1963. And he had just been promoted to design specialist at the time, or senior designer, as they call him. And we just have known each other back over the years. So I was quite flattered that he would want me. Mm-hmm. So I did. I put together some names and built up a department, a theoretical department, and called him back and told him about it. So he came back in April of that year. In the meantime, he was running back and forth to Europe, so I set up the whole studio, and we started on the 79 Mustang. The Mustang was already underway in another studio, and Jack just came back with a whole different idea of how the car should be based on his experience in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And that car went into survey the last minute, one of the last chances we had to survey the car before he had to decide. And we won. We won with that design.
Mm-hmm.
So
that was the
79 Mustang.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we were quite pleased about that. And get some changes to the car because the car was based on the Fairmont undercarriage.
Right.
And at that time, the package didn't allow us to slope off the hood. We couldn't get a faster windshield. We couldn't get tumble home.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack just went ahead and did it. Did a car that way, the way he felt it should be.
Tumble home is
tumble home is the curvature of the glass, how much the roof curves in from the side view.
Mm-hmm.
And we put more tumble home to the car. We lowered the hood. And got a faster windshield, and it sold. We won. Somehow engineering suddenly figured out a way to do it. You know, they told us we couldn't change the radiator support, not the radiator, but the aprons, we call it aprons that run from the windshield to the headlights. Well, lo and behold, we found out the apron was a three-piece apron. Oh, sure, they could change the front part. They'd give you a lower hood. You know, these kind of games that are played drive you nuts. Once management makes a decision to do something, then suddenly the engineers find all kinds of ways to get around the problem and give you what you want.
Perhaps you could expand on that a bit, the relationship between the designer and the body engineers.
We have a good relationship now, a good rapport.
But at one time it wasn't such.
That's right. And that's because we put on our business hat and realized that, hey, you know, we want quality. It starts with us.
Right.
If we're going to hang all kinds of ornaments and junk in the car, they're going to fall off later. That isn't quality. So we become more businesslike in that respect, too.
But previously there was sort of a competition, wasn't it?
Yeah, not a competition. Our problem is that design is always looking for something new.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the whole idea to us is, let's get flush glass. Let's get aerodynamic headlights. Let's do all these things. Let's get more tread. Let's get the wheels poked out there. Engineering generally is reluctant to change. You know, they won't go ahead and try anything new. And I think maybe a lot of this is philosophy. I think that they're, maybe it's the Ford culture. I don't know what. But if you screw up, if you make a mistake, you're out.
Right.
You know, rather than, well, okay, so you made a mistake, but at least you had three good ideas last month. And that's what we're after.
Right.
So I think it's an attitude like that. Plus, with all these suits they've had, you know, pinto gas tanks.
Oh, yes, they must be.
I think the engineers are very gun shy.
Yeah.
Very gun shy. So they're very reluctant to try new things.
They want it known that it's your your concept, not
right.
theirs.
That's right.
They'll try it only if they get some kind of approval.
Right. So they can find ways of saying it's not feasible.
Mm-hmm.
If planning doesn't want something, why, they can say it's too costly. I say, well, that's $9 over, you know, our assumptions. Well, it probably isn't $9 at all. It might be 20 cents.
Uh-huh.
But you see, if it's the old game. If people are reluctant to buy or if they don't want something, then they'll find ways of undermining it.
Did this situation give rise to the concept of the feasibility department?
Feasibility studio?
Studio in Design Center?
No, that was just an easier way. It was a centralizing of all the feasibility.
I see.
Which is no longer is now. Now we've gone back to the studios. We have a team approach to everything now.
Mm-hmm.
Like my design execs are head of the team,
mm-hmm.
and the modelers and designers are under them, and the studio engineers on a dotted line to them.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea is that, okay, this team is going to work on this project. You're going to develop this design, and you're going to carry it through to feasibility to the end, to what we call the service layout release.
Ah, I see.
And what that does is keep continuity. Because the original group that designed the car is most familiar with it, and therefore they'll know if any little subtle change occurs from the engineering drawings.
Mm-hmm.
They'll know every aspect of the car.
So there's no chance of a slip up.
Right, right. Yeah. Feasibility studio, I used to go in there, and then suddenly design was lost. I'd go in there and I'd see a clay modeler doing away, doing that. Oh, I don't know, I was told to, I got the drawing here. Well, who told you that? Well, the engineer over there. There's one engineer. Well, he's not here right now. I mean, it was just like trying to get hold of a greased pig. I couldn't find out anything was happening to my cars.
Now you've got, as you say, a team approach, and each design studio has its own feasibility.
Right, so, right.
Yeah. It worked well?
Yes, uh-huh. So far it's working great.
Yeah.
And also now we've taken over the aero. We used to have a separate aero clay modeling department, aerodynamics.
Mm-hmm.
Just in the past week or two, now those modelers have been dispersed in the exterior studios, and now the exec is responsible for the aero model as well. So we got everything. We'll have the feasibility, the aero, you know, the original theme,
mm-hmm.
and carry it through that way. And the continuity, I think, is so important. As soon as you get a new group of people involved in the program, they got new ideas, they don't know what's happened in the past, they don't care,
mm-hmm.
and that's where you run into trouble.
Whose idea was that? Or did it come out, evolve?
Well, that evolved. I had to share my studio with the aero modelers, and that was becoming a problem. Because one end of the studio, one end of the building, has the best bridges, the most accurate bridges. And my large car studio had a couple of cars coming up to go into those bridges.
Mm-hmm.
And they were being taken up by the aero modelers. So I finally got what we call the top team, you know, the Jack Telnack and the directors meet.
Mm-hmm.
And in the staff meeting, I just told them, I said, look, I've got a problem. that is coming up. I need those bridges. We have to disperse the aero modelers to do something. So that's the decision came to do that.
Bridges play a large part in...
That's the heart of the business.
Are they fairly sophisticated now?
No.
Has the technology improved in recent years?
It has, but we don't have that equipment. Ours is still the old bridges, the same bridges over there back in 1955.
Is it a problem of cost?
Tremendous cost to replace all them. Yeah. But it's a problem because you just don't get the accuracy. The bridges go out of adjustment. We have to get the millwrights in to readjust them and check them out.
And you need minute accuracy.
Yeah. All the modelers are just crying for new equipment.
Mm-hmm.
But right now it's just too cut. We're just getting out of the slump, so
right,
I don't know.
Exactly,
we
yeah.
may be able to replace the equipment someday.
But
it's a problem because half the building has bridge plates or rails that sit above the ground,
mm-hmm.
or floor. And only in this one area of the building are they flush in the floor,
mm-hmm.
and accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And the other bridges can only be used for theme development, mm-hmm. because you can never do an accurate model.
So there's really sort of a traffic jam for those
yeah.
two.
And that's what happens. I had to bring cars over once
yeah.
they're approved.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're checking them right now and they're finding all kinds of discrepancies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's a serious problem, the inaccuracy of those other bridges.
The same economy program ditched the wind tunnel you had scheduled.
Yes.
Over here on Oakwood. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Too bad.
I think that's coming back around, though.
Oh, is it? Yeah. The pilots are still there, so they got.
Yeah, it won't be built there, though, oddly enough. They're
going
someplace else in the complex.
Oh, okay.
I don't know, but it looks like that's becoming more positive
good.
Every day. I think we'll
yeah.
be getting the wind tunnel.
Must be kind of a logistics problem going down to where? Are you going to the University of Georgia? You going now?
Mm-hmm. Georgia and
Maryland
previously. For the 3/8.
Yeah, yeah. It would be good if you could have one down. Does,
oh,
that would
be great.
General Motors got one at the Tech Center?
Yep, sure they do.
And have they got the newest bridges also?
Well, I'm sure they do. I don't know what they've got out there, yeah, but they probably do. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, I interrupted you at a very critical point. Jack Telnack has asked you to come on as his design exec
mm-hmm.
for what program?
That was light car exterior, and the main program was the Mustang.
Uh-huh.
And we got that through, as I explained.
Uh-huh.
Now, then, something happened. I was with him through January of 78, and then I get called again by my friend, Mr. De La Rosa, to join him in the Advanced Vehicles Concepts Industrial Design Office.
Ah.
And
Don De La Rosa at this point is, what's his position?
He was executive director.
Of this segment?
Yeah,
yeah,
right. So I left Jack, and I went back with Don. But this time was a little different twist. I had the Advanced Studio back here,
mm-hmm.
and he told me that he was going to involve me in the GIA operations.
Uh-huh.
Now, up to that time, Don De La Rosa had just protected that GIA operation with a, nobody got near that. That was his baby.
Yeah.
So I was surprised to hear him say that he was going to involve me.
Now, what was GIA doing for Ford at this point?
At that time, GIA built, I think they still do, about 12 cars a year.
Uh-huh.
And various kinds of cars. They can do what they call EPO-wood. EPO-wood is a form of plastic material that they put over styrofoam.
Mm-hmm.
It hardens, and then they can sand that, and it becomes like a fiberglass model.
Mm-hmm.
And they did, they could do an EPO-wood model, which is a static model. You know, it's just has a dummy interior and so on.
Mm-hmm.
They also built drivables, steel drivable cars. Mm-hmm. They have the facilities there to do it. And
this is in Turin.
In Turin.
Uh-huh.
And just fascinating to see these craftsmen turn out an automobile and pound out the sheet metal and
mm-hmm.
mend it and twist it and weld it, and just unbelievable. Or build up a B-pillar and hang a door on it and get the doors will work beautifully, and a one-off car, incredible. So they did projects for us back here. That could be a program that you're working on at the time. Let's see, this would be back around 78, so it could be a 1980 program.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be asked, we'd give them the package drawings and so on, and they would develop their own designs. That was supposed to be our think tank. Filippo Sapino, he was the manager of the operation.
Uh-huh.
He'd always call it the Ford's think tank.
Di Tommaso was not involved with Guillaume,
no,
was he, at this point?
No, he was gone.
He was gone.
But, that was the same facility that Di Tommaso had and did the Panteras
in. Pantera, yeah. Did you work, have anything to do with Pantera?
Mm-hmm. No, just some facelift work under De La Rosa back around 74.
So De La Rosa had been involved with the Panther?
Oh, yes, very much so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Di Tommaso, at this point, was no longer with Guillaume?
No.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, he was gone. And Filippo was hired and put in as managing director of Guillaume under Don De La Rosa.
Uh-huh.
And then in April of 1978, Don Kopka, Don De La Rosa, and myself went over there.
Uh-huh.
And went through the GIA facility and also went to the Touran Auto Show. And I guess that was my indoctrination, you know, that, okay, now this is what you're going to be doing. So then...
what assignments did he have for you?
In GIA?
De La Rosa asking you, I interrupt you at a critical point where De La Rosa had asked you to come in to work with the GIA.
Well, we had, it was still rather hazy what I was going to do with Guilla. You know, he was always so protective of Guilla that you're never sure what I wasn't sure what he meant. You know, I don't know, am I going to run it? Am I going to go there now and then? Am I going to take a peek or what? And he was so clever, he never would tell me. But anyway, this trip over after April, I was supposed to go over with him right after Memorial Day, May of 1978. And at that time, something happened, and Don De La Rosa was retired from the company, and Don Kopka took over.
The special
vehicles and all that. So I worked then for Don Kopka. Under him, we started the Prove 1.
Ah.
The Prove 1 was my car.
Yeah.
And we had a young designer then, Dennis Reardon, who just come from, I hired him from American Sunroof, and he came up with this concept, and we put it together in clay model form. And I had Bill Kramer then as design manager. And I got this idea that, well, you know, let's involve the building. I got the aero people. And I said, hey, look, you know, we got a car here that has a potential, I think, for good aero. Why don't you guys work with us and see what we can get out of this? You know, let's get the lowest drag number we can. I got the interior studios and said, well, look, you do an interior for the car. And I talked to De La Rosa and Bournet about it, and they agreed, well, that's a good way to work. So in other words, it was kind of a joint project. We started the exterior, we got the engineers involved in the interior studios, and we did. We got that car down to 0.25,
wow,
which at that time was pretty darn good.
Yeah.
And then they decided, well, let's involve GIA. Let's have GIA build a drivable model of this car, and we can exploit it. We can drive it around the track, use it for publicity, and so on. So that involved Filippo, and he built a steel drivable version of it.
So the first Prove 1 was really, the drivable prototype was his.
Yeah.
From your design.
Now, the car we showed at was it Geneva or Frankfurt, I think it was Frankfurt, was the fiberglass model, the first model ever done. And then after that, Filippo built the steel drivable.
It created quite a stir.
It sure did. Even the German newspapers on the front page, which is unheard of, an American car on the front page of the German newspapers.
First time an American car appealed to them.
Yeah, yeah. So we were quite pleased with that. And then, of course, that just instigated Probe 2, Probe 3, Probe 4, Probe 5. So.
Now, I hate to stop you at this point, but can you give us a sort of an idea as to how this sequence of probes fitted into the company's center's thinking of this time?
Yeah, into the aero end of it.
Right. Right.
Because we decided that aero was going to be our thing. You know.
Now, when you say decided, who and at what point?
I think Jack Telnak and Kopka both.
Did they bring it back? Jack brought it back from England, more or less?
No, I don't think so. At that time, I don't think, well, maybe a little bit, but aero really didn't start. We didn't get into that really until we started doing the probe. I'd say back in the 60s, you know, 78
okay.
And 79 in that period. Okay.
So it was really you and Don and Don Kopka and Don De La Rosa
and your
assistant designers.
And I also think it was Don Peterson. You know, Peterson became
a Ford of Europe
guy. And he became president of the company.
Mm-hmm.
And he came over one day shortly after becoming president, just to go through the building with us to see what was what. Went through everything, spent all day, interiors, exteriors, instrument panels, door panels, you name it. And he finally said to Jack, he says, well, is this what you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
Are you happy with what you have? And Jack says, well, no, not really. well, what would you want to do? He says, why don't you show me what you want to do? So that's when we get off this very boxy, square look.
Right.
And that's when we decided, well, you know, we should have a theme for our designs, and we should have a reason for them, a functional reason.
Okay.
And aerodynamics certainly would be a functional reason, because now we're into this cafe problem. We've got to keep improving our, you know, corporate average fuel economy.
Yes.
And what better way than through aero? That won't cost you anything. Just design the car, and you may save 1 or 2 miles per gallon.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how that all started. It was Peterson giving us the opportunity to do what we want, what we felt was right in design. And it was also the Probe 1 kicking that off.
Right.
And then they felt, well, we're into this aero thing. Let's continue. Let's continue to try and improve our aero in our advanced vehicles. And whatever we come up with could be RevOS or the production cars.
So really rare, very convenient way of inexpensive way to reduce your fuel economy.
You bet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can save a lot of money. I mean, you don't have to redesign the car or go to exotic materials. It's just the shape of the car as it goes through the wind.
Did it occur to you at that time that why didn't we think of this before? Or why didn't someone mention this before?
Well, I think aero has always...
You knew aero, I've been around for years.
But I don't think anybody put that much emphasis on it, because gasoline was, what, 30, 40 cents a gallon?
Of course. Nobody, it wasn't until the crunch that you really decided.
Nobody was really worried about the cost of gasoline. But you go up Telegraph Road, the price wars, where you just chose the station you wanted.
I can remember 19 cents a gallon.
Mm-hmm. So I think it was this Arab crunch in 74 that kind of did it to us.
Yeah. Well, this must have been an exciting time in your career.
It was.
At the beginning of what turned out to be a very important segment in design history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was very interesting to work with the Ghia Studios. That was quite an experience. Because, you know, the Italians are, it's just a different way of life. They're more laid back. And Filippo was kind of laid back. And I was always hot to trot. Yeah, let's go. What are we going to do here? What are we going to do there? And kind of be sitting in his office in the afternoon. He just kind of dozed off. And, you know, he really wasn't it.
Siesta time. Yeah.
Yeah. But
was Tom Giarda Jr. over there at that time?
Giarda had just about left.
Oh, had he?
Yeah. Uh-huh. He had left then. We saw him a couple of times at the auto shows, and Filippo wanted to avoid him. He didn't want to run into him.
He was connected with the Tommaso regime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's. I don't. There was something that went on before then. Giarda worked at Ghia as kind of a consultant, I guess, or part time.
Uh-huh.
He wasn't full time, but I thought he was. Yeah, but Filippo told me no, he was only like a consultant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Filippo felt he didn't need him because he felt he had the abilities.
Sure.
It was one of those things.
Well, it's worked out very well. Do you still have the connection with Ghia in that sense?
No, because then in 79. Matter of fact, I took my wife over to Europe on that trip to Ghia and then to the auto show in Frankfurt, and we were in somewhere in Switzerland, and I got a call from Don Kopke, and he says, well, Bob, he says you're transferred. I says, what? I says, what do you mean I'm transferred? I can. Yeah, he says you're going to be director of small car and truck exterior. I says, gee whiz, okay. So in 79 to 80, I was... At that time, then, working for Gail Haldeman. Gail Haldeman was the executive director.
One quick question. Is there anything you can say about why the Ghia connection was severed?
Well, it has been severed.
Oh, it was?
Oh, no, it's still
just your connection.
Just me. My
okay, that's, oh, yeah. That was, I misunderstood you.
No. It's still going
that's
on strong.
Thought, yeah.
Yeah, Dave Reese now is running that.
Oh, is he? Oh.
Yeah, under Don Kopke.
Oh.
See, because then we split in 1980. You know, it was no longer just Design Center. It was North American Design and design staff.
And this is just about the time that happened. Do you have any perceptions on how that came about?
Well, no, not
quite an interesting
really. Thing. I don't know. That was the time when Gene retired and...
Telneck was coming up strong.
Well, I don't know. He wasn't that strong. I didn't think. No stronger than Gail Haldeman or Don Kopke, mm-hmm. I didn't think. So that was kind of a surprise to me when that split occurred, and I don't know why it did. And I don't know why Don Kopke was made a vice president and Jack wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I think in this advanced world, you know, doing advanced properties and working with GIA, that's fine, but the production end of it, the responsibility there is much greater to me. I mean, that's it. You're putting a product out there that's got to sell or it's not going to sell.
So really, the vice president should have gone to the production.
Well, design. That's the way I felt, you know, so, that's yeah. My own observations.
And that the advanced studio could have kept its own orbit.
Well, I ran that whole operation myself as a director, so,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, granted, it has expanded and there's more emphasis on it because Don Peterson is very much interested in Don Kopka's operation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's a different emphasis than there was when I had it, but still in all, I'm sorry for Jack because he's got a terrific responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All of North American automotive design. And it never happened. And then that split caused a problem in the building because here, people were a family. That building is a family.
Right. Yeah.
Well, the family is broken up now.
I mean, it's NAD versus
design staff. Yeah, and they each the employees are seeing little perks that staff gets and they don't get, and there's animosity and there's disagreements. It's really too bad. At our end, no problem.
Yeah,
Kopka's a wonderful guy, and he and Jack, everybody, we get along fine, mm-hmm. cooperative and so on. But I see it down in the lower ranks that there's dissatisfaction. They don't like the split, and here these people work together for years side by side. Now they're you know, it's kind of like the Berlin Wall almost. I shouldn't say that. That sounds terrible. But
apparently, it was a compromise at a fairly high level. Someone.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know. I never did know the story. I don't know the story. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But, to me, if I was doing it, I would go back to one.
Right.
One design center.
Have a director heading the advanced studio.
Yeah.
So you're in small car and truck exterior. This must have been quite a change for you.
Yeah. I went from. Well, the glamour of auto shows and show cars and right back into the production end of it again.
Uh-huh.
And
the bread and butter items.
Right.
Yeah.
And there I worked on the 81 Escort and the Granada, the Cougar, 81 period.
Mm-hmm.
And there I was moved around a bit by Gail. I had started out with just small car, then I had a pickup truck exterior, and I worked on the Ranger pickup and the Bronco 2. And also the Tempo Topaz.
Oh, yeah.
That car line was coming on strong at the time. Now, that's right around 1980. That's when Jack took over.
Mm-hmm.
And Gene retired.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack came in and looked at what we were doing on the Tempo Topaz. And he saw a rendering that Fritz Mayhew had done. And he says, model that quickly, because we had a survey coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So we did this car real quick, got it in the survey with the cars that have been going along.